Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And good news, everyone, Gabe's back!
Whoa!
Yay, that's right. Gabe Haggard is once again gracing us with his presence. Happy to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And also joining us today is an old friend of mine from my movie production days, Tad Chamberlain. Say hi, Tad.
Hey, hey, hey.
A few weeks ago we had Ted, now we have Tad.
Yeah. I've been called Ted a time or two.
And when Tad's not busy writing, directing, and producing his own movies and music videos, he's studying the great masters of cinema. Masters including, say, Robert Bresson, whose film O Hussard Balthazar we'll be discussing today.
For example.
And listeners who've seen O Hussard Balthazar can attest, it's a bit of a downer, to say the least. So given the solemnity of our first movie, I thought maybe we should keep it a little lighter for our second topic. So we're going to discuss a parable about a bloody violent uprising aboard a train bound for nowhere. Yay!
You see what you did there?
Yeah.
You see what you did there?
Yeah.
When you first pitched this to me a couple weeks ago, I thought, this is brilliant. Yeah. It's the polar opposite
exactly.
of O Hussard Balthazar, so it should be fun.
Yeah, so listen up to find out if the recent blockbuster Snowpiercer managed to lift our spirits at all. And just in case that doesn't do the trick, we'll wrap everything up with our final note of positivity. You guys ready?
Ready.
Yes, I am.
All aboard!
Woo! Woo! Yay!
First up, we're going to discuss the number 16 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Robert Bresson's 1966 film, O Hussard Balthazar, which roughly translated means The Random Fate of Balthazar. The film follows the life of a donkey named Balthazar. The audience observes Balthazar as he transitions from foal into adult and eventually into old age. We are made to watch as he's passed along from human to human, and with each new owner, he suffers a range of different painful indignities. However, the donkey takes his injuries in stride and nobly continues on in his life of misery. Running parallel to Balthazar's story of suffering is the story of Marie, played by Anne Wazemski, who is Balthazar's first owner. In the beginning of the film, Marie seems to be a relatively happy girl, but a series of events, ranging in awfulness from unfortunate to horrific, throws her life in a completely new, appalling direction. Just as Balthazar suffers countless cruelties at the hands of men, so does Marie. They suffer and suffer, and when they can't take any more suffering, they die. Or at least Balthazar dies. We aren't certain of Marie's fate. But if the events of the film are any indication, nothing good awaits Marie in this lifetime. Now, this film is not for everyone. But one thing's for certain, once you've seen O Hussard Balthazar, you'll never look at a pack animal the same way again. All right, so let's do this thing. Gabe, do you like the movie?
I think this is the first movie on the list that I don't enjoy watching.
Okay.
It's a bit uncomfortable to watch, and it's very, very dour.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, I'm not disappointed that I watched it. I appreciate it, and it's pretty interesting to dissect and get to the bottom of what it is.
Okay, Tad, how about you? What did you think of the movie?
I love this film. I had seen it once when they first restored it for the Criterion release about 10, 12 years ago. I saw it in the theater and was really moved by it and really impressed by the restraint that it shows, the minimalism of the film. But I hadn't seen it since, and I have to watch films two or three times at least to really kind of, you know, understand them and get into them and be able to talk intelligently about them. So it was fun to go back and be able to watch it again.
So how had your impression changed from the first time you saw it?
I don't know that there was a significant change in my impression. I this time now, since I knew I was going to have to be coming and talking here about it, I dug a little bit more into some interviews and reviews and that kind of thing to see what other people were saying about it. And I just became more and more impressed with Bresson's technique and what he was trying to do, and it makes me want to go see a lot more Bresson films. I'm only familiar with one or two other of his films. So.
Well, we've got a few more coming up, have an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, I did not like this film at all. And I've heard people say that it's boring. I did not find it boring. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated. I was glued to my seat. But Bresson has this, seems to me to have this contempt for humanity that was a real turnoff for me. And the characters seem to me to be more like puppets than actual real life human beings. For whatever reason, I just, like, Bresson doesn't seem to believe that we have free will. And with that taken out of the equation, it just seems to be about how humans and other creatures that that lack free will are at the mercy of those who take advantage, who are able to take advantage.
And what is it that makes you think that Bresson doesn't believe in free, doesn't give his characters free will?
Well, the way that Marie and Balthazar, particularly Marie, take their suffering, and it's just assumed that they will suffer. And they don't seem to have any character motivation. I never understand where Marie is coming from. She seems to be imprisoned by her boyfriend. Or that
relationship,
yeah. her assailant, and that character doesn't ring true for me at all. So
you don't think that that he was trying to portray a character that is just going through, you know, a lot of suffering? You know, I mean, I think an example is her father and the legal trouble that her father is in. That is fairly clearly, I felt, due to his own hard-headedness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He, and so there are choices that he has made. And then with Marie, you see that she had another choice. She had that other boy, mm-hmm. Jacques, that she could, and I think it is portrayed as she could have gone with Jacques,
mm-hmm.
and she chooses not to. She is making choices, and then suffering the horrific consequences of those choices. You know, it's just like even in when Gerard begins to pursue her, she, you know, starts to run and then stops and comes back.
Right, which is not, I saw that as she was giving in. She saw that she had no choice, that this is her destiny and she is meant to suffer. That is her lot in life. And I don't, I mean, I guess maybe it's Stockholm Syndrome, but that to me is not that interesting. We never get any real sense of her internal monologue. We don't get a sense of her character. She's sort of this blank slate. And I think that's partially because of the way Bresson directed his actors, which he apparently would make them do take after take, mm-hmm. until all the performative aspects are out of the characters and it's just this very naturalistic acting style.
Mm-hmm.
But in her case, I felt like what we ended up with was this very sort of muted performance, and almost like I felt like it was flat. To me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, that is part of his style. I mean, I was watching one of the interviews on the Criterion disc about where they interviewed him, and he talks in detail about this idea. He didn't want to use professional actors. He didn't want to use a trained donkey, even, which gave him a lot of headaches, you know. He waited to shoot that one scene where he had to have the circus scene where he's doing the multiplication tables. He had to train the donkey for that. So they shot that scene after the rest of the film. They took some time to train the donkey because they, you know, they didn't want the donkey to become trained as an actor, so to speak, for the rest of the film. But he feels that the more he has them do it, they will leave out this sort of theatrical, more emotive, over the top kind of thing that he's trying to get to real life. It's funny you say you didn't find it real, because that's his whole thing, is he's trying to achieve realism by getting rid of the artifices of acting,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
So
and
then
that's,
you
it
end
just
up
didn't
just,
work for me, I
well,
guess.
Well, I mean, I think another thing we might want to keep in consideration is she is not the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
So we aren't going to get a full and complete picture of what is happening in her head.
Mm-hmm.
Because Balthazar is the protagonist.
Sure, but mm-hmm. I do think it's important to have well-rounded characters in your film. And I just felt like her purpose was to suffer. As was every character's purpose in this film.
Well, because that's, I mean, and I understand, like I said, I don't necessarily like completely enjoy watching this film, but it does seem to me to be in many ways, you know, I guess you might refer to it as experimental or a little bit, but that I think is kind of the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a meditation on suffering. So you have your protagonist that is suffering. You could say, you could make the argument that is suffering in sort of the correct way, you know, is accepting the suffering, and then all the other characters mm-hmm. who are not accepting it well, and you have her at the end kind of going crazy. You have her father who just literally rolls over and dies,
mm-hmm.
and it's only Balthazar that seems to accept suffering in sort of the correct, in a noble manner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think part of, like, one of the things that Bresson says that it's about everybody, almost every character's sin in this, or their fault, or their flaw, is pride.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Marie, by the end, you know, she refuses to leave Gerard. Until it's too late, she refuses to get back with Jacques, and there's this sort of, the pride is part of the, her father's whole issue with the lawsuit is pride.
Well, she cannot believe that Jacques could love her, mm-hmm. and Jacques is telling her, like, yes, I love you, like, we'll never speak of it again, you know, and she is too prideful to accept his love, to let him love her.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't mind that the movie is a meditation on suffering. That suffering is very important. It's an important part of life. It is a part of life. But to me, when you stack the deck in this way, where you have an embodiment of pure evil in Gerard, and you have the embodiment of pure innocence in a helpless animal, and Marie, who is in her way helpless,
mm-hmm.
I feel like you're stacking the deck. That to me does not get to the essence of what suffering is about, because that is, sociopaths are rare in life, and the reason that humans suffer is a lot of the time due to, you know, just plain old selfishness or miscommunications or just illness, or, I mean, there are so many different reasons why life can be very challenging. But I didn't feel like this film addressed any of those, really.
Well, I think in a way you could say that it gets to a sort of true essence of an understanding of suffering, which is to say that suffering ultimately is sort of this unintelligible thing that we can't grasp, you know, like the age-old question, you know, why do bad things happen to good people?
Mm-hmm.
And so by embodying the character who is accepting suffering in the correct way as a helpless donkey is sort of to illustrate the fact that we are not capable, that humans are not capable of accepting and dealing with suffering properly.
So I wanted to talk about, you say that Balthazar accepts suffering nobly, and Bresson was a Catholic. So do you think maybe this idea of noble suffering could be in some way connected to his Catholicism?
I definitely think, I mean, that's one of the things that everybody talks about. It's his Catholicism, and the films he did before this was The Prison Cycle, where he did a film about Joan of Arc. And that's, a lot of it has to do with this idea of suffering. And the thing that Paul Schrader looks at him about is this idea of transcendence, and that through suffering is how we can transcend our humanity and touch something higher or greater or, you know, other than us. And that's part of, like, the whole... The thing that Schrader looks at when he looks at Ozu, as well as Bresson, and to a lesser extent Carl Theodore Dreyer, is that they have these very restrained styles, very little for Ozu especially, almost no camera movement, not a lot of, over-the-top acting, very like we just talked about. And for him, one of the things he does is connects it to medieval art and that there and in religious practice, in religions like Catholicism, that has ceremony involved, there's repetition, that his analysis of these guys is that they use this sort of repetitive film style as a way to allow us to use the cinema as almost a ceremony that we're going through. We learn to expect the certain rhythms and the certain storylines that reveal these things about humanity and what it is. And so with Hussar Balthazar, I look at it as almost like a medieval morality play, like Everyman. And it's even said explicitly towards the end of the film, the mother says Balthazar is a saint. She says that. And then we go to the next scene and he's going through this religious parade and he's, you know, and so Balthazar, I think, is sort of the everyman. And it's this idea that Gabe was talking about of like exploring how we should experience and deal with suffering. And that's how we can find transcendence above our, you know, this human existence. Mm. And that's, you know, he at the end of the film. Can we do spoilers here when we talk
spoilers.
About the end?
Yeah. I mean, it's 1966.
Right, yeah, you know, it's past the statute of limitations on spoilers. You know, Balthazar lays down in a field of sheep, and he's in amongst the sheep. And he's, if you use the Christ references, he's not a Christ-like figure. He would be leading the sheep as a shepherd if he was Christ. He's an idea of the perfect saint or the perfect disciple who's accepting the end of his life in this Christ-like way amongst, you know, Christ's sheep.
Yeah, and see, and that's the thing. When I saw that, I thought that the analogy was that he is a Christ-like figure, because there are a few other references, other things that made me think that he is supposed to be Christ-like, namely that he is juxtaposed to the humans as accepting the suffering in a noble way. And again, juxtaposing him to all the humans is kind of, as, you know, just an animal, is kind of setting him apart from the humans and to say that, look, you know, you can't suffer correctly, but this something different, which is, you know, the Christ figure, can suffer correctly. And then I also noticed towards the end when he's with the last guy where he's walking around the mill, the guy is whipping him, and a couple times he falls. Mm. And so there's a Christ reference, Christ carrying his cross. Mm-hmm. And then there's a little sequence where the man offers him some water, and he refuses to drink. And when Christ is hanging on the cross, they offer him something to drink, and he refuses.
Right. Marie fastens him that laurel of flowers, kind of looks like a crown of thorns.
Yeah, I think you can definitely make that case.
And then when he goes and lays down with the sheep, you know, Christ is with his sheep, you know. Mm-hmm. There's always that, you know, imagery that Christ is the shepherd and with his sheep and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I probably can't answer this question, but how much does Bresson's Catholicism contribute to the ethos of this film? Does this seem like a Catholic film?
Well, I think it appears as though his Catholicism is the foundation from which he approaches his style. But I don't know, I feel like it's kind of neither here nor there in a sense, like how Catholic or not Catholic the film is. I mean, I think it works on a lot of levels. It can be seen as extremely religious, you know, or it can just be seen as a meditation on human suffering, on the unintelligibility of it, and, you know, sort of juxtaposing accepting or not accepting suffering.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, one of the things that I had trouble with is this film seems to view humanity in binary terms. There's good and there's evil, there's innocence and there's cruelty. And that's something that I just don't recognize in my life or in humanity. There's more shades of gray. So, Ted, I mean, you've expressed the most positive view of this film.
Right.
So is that, I mean, how do you reconcile that?
I don't know.
That?
To me, to a large extent, I think you're right. There's definitely these two extremes. I think there's a little more gray in there than maybe we're giving it credit for. But I for me, it works if I think of it, like, as I mentioned before, as like a morality tale, as a parable. I'm not expecting to have the same sorts of narrative expectations from a parable than I have from a novel or something
right,
like that.
Fair.
And so that's how if I think of it in that way, I'm less concerned about about sort of that semi-simplistic way of breaking things down.
Yeah, and I think that's right. If you approach it from that direction, it becomes, in a way, less important that, you know, his character development is, quote-unquote, lacking in various aspects, because that's not so much what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think he's trying to say about the nature of suffering?
For me, he's using Balthazar, and he even said this in one of the interviews that I watched. Like, he says, you know, you have to remember that Marie is not our main character, it's Balthazar, and he's the one who's going through, it's kind of what Gabe was saying, is that it's an exploration of, here are people who are suffering, and here's this being, this dumb beast, who accepts his suffering and is able to, in the end, live this blameless life and a Christ-like life, whether you think of him as a Christ figure or a disciple, saint figure, that Balthazar is the example of how to go through and accept this suffering and live a peaceful life by accepting suffering and being disassociated from pride and all these other lust and all these other things that
right.
we see the characters exhibiting, greed and so forth.
Right, yeah. And I wanted to mention that some have suggested, because Balthazar has seven owners throughout the course of the film, that might correlate with the seven deadly sins. Some have suggested that. I don't know if it's true. But I guess,
I wonder what I wonder about Marie, how good or bad Marie is. She does seem to be innocent, you know, in the beginning, and things take a horrible turn for her, but by the end, she's kind of bad.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of bad news, like trying to get the old man.
For her, that was the most disturbing part of the film for me, was that moment where she's been apparently raped or assaulted, and the shot of her facing the wall, sitting naked, blew me away when I saw that image, because it's so far beyond what other extreme things we might have seen earlier in the film.
Well, yeah,
extreme for this film.
Yeah, and I almost thought that was an incredible. That image was so incredibly powerful, because I almost noticed watching the film up to that point, he was almost too careful to never show any sort of a hint of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made that one single shot like so much more powerful and so much more shocking,
mm-hmm.
and made you like so much more emotional, made you feel for so much more.
Right.
I mean, this film is all about the ellipses. You know, there's so many things where we go from one scene to the next, and there's zero explanation about how Balthazar got to be owned by this person, or how these things happen. There's he leaves a lot. And that's one of I hate to just keep referencing interviews, but the interview I was just watching with Bresson, he's like, his whole thing is, art is about showing as little as you possibly can. That if we're just showing everything, that's not art, that's reproduction. Mm. And art is about juxtaposing images and sounds and showing as little as possible to convey the most amount. So that's, I think, perfectly what you just said is so true, because that he shows so little up into that point that it's that much more impactful when it happens.
Yeah.
I had one other thing. I don't know if we're winding down on this but something you had mentioned earlier that I had thought about in relation to contrasting it to another film. You talked about how, and your feeling of it coming away from it was that Bresson had a very negative, harsh view of humanity itself. And when I was watching this, it reminded me a lot of Buñuel's Viridiana, contrasting that, which had a similar thing where we're in this kind of small town kind of thing. I mean, it's on an estate or something. But there, everybody is ugly and depraved, and it's about the degradation of this woman, of Viridiana, and he's super critical, obviously. I mean, if you remember the famous tableau scene where they recreate the Last Supper, but with all the bums that have taken over the house and are destroying the house. And it's a very negative view of humanity and about the degradation of a person. And that film kept coming to mind as a contrasting, this film kind of, these people are suffering, but to me it was, and the people are not good people in general, or they exhibit these flaws that make them not, you know, perfect and Christ-like and so forth like Balthazar. But I felt like Bresson treats them with less judgment, that it's, okay, this is what humanity is like. It's a statement of fact that people have these flaws. And but I didn't feel like he ever looks down or is saying these are bad people. They're people with flaws.
Right.
And the way to overcome that is then exhibited in Balthazar as our example.
Yeah. I think part of my issue is that as a human being, I just don't believe in noble suffering. So maybe that is my disconnect there. Mm-hmm. So that could be it. And also, one final question before we get to the final question.
The snowplow? Are we on the snowplow?
I've read in several interviews, this film, people seem to mention, like, bring up that this ain't no Disney movie. This comes up a lot. And as I was watching...
Never at any point while I was watching, I was like, oh, you know what this reminds me of? Dumbo!
It totally reminded me of Dumbo, though. Just with a very different outcome. Because I think they use Disney and Bresson use animals in a very similar way, which is to elicit sympathy from the audience. I think that we, as humans, respond more to the suffering of animals than we do other humans, or at least some of us do.
Well, because you never know the backstory of human suffering. So you, in any situation, you're never quite sure where the blame lies. Mm-hmm. And it's a far more complicated thing. Whereas the suffering of animals, they don't deserve it. They seem to not deserve it. There's nothing they can do about it. They in no way chose it. And so all it is just sympathy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas like with a human, you're like, yeah, but did he kind of deserve that? You know, you're never 100% sure. If you have the whole picture, you know, like the suffering of human, while being far more intricate and ultimately is going to be far more devastating. You know, you're going to be far more devastated by a loved one's death than you will be by, you know, a mockingbird's death, because you know the loved one, and so you know the whole situation. You're intimately familiar with it. But in terms of, you know, storytelling and just, all right, we're trying to elicit sympathy, just throw up that puppy, shoot him in the head, you know? in a very blunt way, like very quickly, you know,
but
you're
going
to get more bang for your buck.
Yeah. I just want to be clear, it is still a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's a good, like, the point that we are using the animal as the vehicle for our emotional connection to the film is definitely true. I don't know. I mean, like, Roger Ebert in his review specifically is like, it's not used like Disney movies because we don't, Disney would, you know, when something bad happens, it'd be, here's a shot of this animal and they're reacting and they look sad. But here, Balthazar is just like a blank slate. He doesn't necessarily react to and give us like the emotional response of the animal in the same way that Disney tends to. So yeah. I don't. I mean, his argument would be that it's not quite.
The one scene that really is like a Disney movie is the scene when in the circus.
Absolutely, yeah.
When he walks into
the
circus.
Big exception.
Yeah, and he's just like, he looks at the tiger, and just like in a Disney movie, like you felt like you could totally see it. He walks in, he looks at it, and the tiger's like, hey, man, you know, what's up, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I thought that too. I was like, that scene felt very different than the whole rest of the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite scenes because it does have this sort of anthropomorphic kind of thing that we start to get that we don't have the rest of the movie. So.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, so it's time for the final question. This is the 16th greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Gabe, do you think it deserves to be number 16?
Over our conversation, I have grown to appreciate it far more.
Okay.
Thanks in large part to Tad.
Oh, gosh.
And,
stop. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Tad, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I how specific I should be if it deserves to be number 16. Definitely top 20 or 40 or somewhere up near the top. But all yeah, right. I love the film.
Okay. In case the past 20 or so minutes haven't tipped you off, I don't think it deserves to be number 16.
Then we've failed.
We've failed. I understand that some people find this movie transcendent, but it pretty much just made me mad. So,
well, see, and Christ can be a very polarizing figure, you know?
Hey, guys. Did you know that Tilda Swinton once said that the donkey in Alcazar Balthazar made her want to be an actor? It's true.
No, I didn't.
You didn't know that?
I did because you told me.
Now I do.
Now you do. Well, it's true, and that bit of trivia will serve as our tenuous connection between topics, because we're now going to discuss Bong Joon-ho's recent release, Snowpiercer, which stars Chris Pine and the aforementioned Tilda Swinton.
Yeah!
See? suddenly it all makes sense. Snowpiercer is an adaptation of a French graphic novel of the same name. It imagines a world where humans, trying to reverse the effects of global warming, accidentally make Earth an uninhabitable winter wasteland. The movie asks us to believe that in this dystopian future, the remainder of all life on Earth, including humans, live aboard a very sturdy bullet train called the Snowpiercer. On this train, the passengers are sorted by class, with the first-class passengers in the front of the train and the dregs in the back. At first, the viewer only sees the living conditions of the lowest of the low, the refugees, packed and herded like cattle. They live in squalor and are threatened by large men with guns and Tilda Swinton. If one of them dares get out of line, the men with guns and Tilda Swinton, acting on behalf of the train's conductor, Wilford, freeze the offender's extremities off. The audience is informed that humanity has lived this way for approximately 17 to 18 years. The movie follows as the lower classes mount and execute a plan to take over the train. All right, so question, guys. Are you a hat, or are you a shoe, or are you some other item of clothing altogether?
Oh,
Tad, we'll start with
you. That's a difficult question, man. Hats and shoes. You know, that's kind of a meta.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that in those terms before, had you? Did I just blow your mind?
Yeah, there's a whole other layer to this film that I hadn't even thought about.
I'm belt, so...
Oh.
Decidedly belt. Gabe?
I'm not going to answer that.
No. I want no part of this.
No.
So this is an effects-laden blockbuster, but it's also a political allegory. Did the two ambitions meld together well for you, or was there a disconnect? Gabe, we'll start with you.
Well, the thing that struck me the most about this film was right at the beginning, the opening credits, I was really struck by the fact that the makeup and hair designer got second billing after the director.
Yeah.
And that was really unique to me. And that ended up being the most unique thing about the entire film.
Ouch!
I don't think that the effects Aladdin-ness of it and the political statement they were trying to make melted together well. The effects weren't very good, and so that always immediately takes you out. Almost any time they stepped out of the train to show you a shot of the outside, it wasn't that great.
Yeah. Well, we should say this isn't exactly a Hollywood blockbuster. It's being distributed by the Weinstein Company, but it was produced in... Much of it was produced by South Korea. So it's sort of a co...
Yeah, and I mean, it's screening in the art house chains.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's certainly not a blockbuster in the, you know, of the Hunger Games, you know, Twilight ilk. But... And a lot of it did play like a low-budget Asian horror film.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of that, not a lot, but, you know, a goodly supply of this gratuitous, just kind of gross violence. And the dialogue was often, you know, sketchy at best. They would sort of repeat themselves. Like, some of it sounded like a translation, the way they would kind of have to, so you're saying I'm going to be the leader. So I'm going to need to lead people, you know? Like, he would say the same thing again and again. And then when it got to the end of the second act, they suddenly realized, oh, wait a minute, we have this protagonist, but we have given him no backstory. We have not described what has happened to this man at all. So everybody, just time out. Take a seat.
Cool.
Take a seat where you are. Everyone take a seat and let him just spew forth what his backstory is. And the alarming thing, as poor as this all was done, it made me like him even less. Because when you have a character, you want to tell a story of like a bad man becoming good or a good man becoming bad. You know, there needs to be some movement, you know, in his character. But there's something to be said for picking a character that is not, you don't want him to be that bad, because then people aren't going to buy it when he becomes good. Mm-hmm. But when he's sitting there describing that he not only kills babies but eats them. You know? Yeah, it's revolting and completely disgusting, and it puts him in this strata of just like, look, dude, that's nasty. You know? And it just paints this horribly depressing picture of humanity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you think they start out with like this class system, you know, where you have the good guys, or sorry, you have the haves and the have-nots, you know, and so as many films do, we cast our lot with the have-nots, you know, and we're going to rally with them. But then as the film goes on, you just learn more and more how they're despicable as well. And so by the end, it's all of humanity, save a small black boy and a young, you know, Asian girl, uh-huh, and a polar bear that are gonna save humanity. And so, you know, I guess at that point, you're sympathetic to those two characters, you know.
All right, Gabe, that was a good 10-minute rant.
That was awesome.
Yeah. Dad, do you have a dissenting opinion by any chance?
I have mixed feelings. I can sympathize with the points that Gabe is making. Here's how I approached the film. I saw the trailer a few months ago, and I love genre movies. I'm more less of an action guy than like horror and thriller sort of thing. But you know, I enjoy a good, you know, effects action movie as much as the next guy. But I saw it and I was like, what I thought of it, it reminded me of, you know, in the original Old Boy, if you've seen it, there's this scene where the guy is fighting his way down a hall and the camera is just basically tracking along with him. And it's just more and more people come up and our hero is just wasting everybody with his hammer. And it's, for me, that's like a brilliant, perfect scene. Mm-hmm. And I thought from watching the trailer, I was like, this movie looks like it's just going to be that scene for the whole movie. You've got this small group of people that are going to fight their way down this hallway like this one guy against overwhelming odds to get to the other end of the hall and win. So I was like, it looks like it'll be fun, but I don't expect it to be that interesting or that, you know, I didn't look at the trailer and go, ugh. And as for a lot of the film, that's kind of what I got. And since that's what I was expecting, I was like, okay, this is fulfilling my expectations. Until the scene where they go through the aquarium and then they go in and they sit down and they have sushi. And I'm like, okay, now the film's doing something different and it's going in a much more interesting direction than where I thought it was going to go. And that scene, from that scene on, it improved for me. The scene in the classroom with the kids and the teacher, and in the end, again, another spoiler ahead, when you have a cute little blonde pregnant teacher who gets a knife to the throat, like I was like, okay, this film is like not pulling any punches. That's amazing to me.
That was great.
That The other thing was, it's maybe my favorite character Tilda Swinton's ever played. It's a cartoonish character, but yes. She was so much fun, and like the teeth, and like I loved it. You know, contrasted to her recent film she also did with John Hurt, Jarmusch's new film Only Lovers Left Alive. I'm a huge Jarmusch fan, but that was my least favorite film of his.
Wow, all right. So. well, we'll have to save that for another podcast. But this film is getting great reviews. It's got like a 90-something on Rotten Tomatoes, believe it or not. Wow. Yeah. And I agree with you, Ted. That sushi scene was amazing, because what the film establishes, it establishes that these lower class, these people in the last car of the train, are the audience proxies. We are meant to sympathize with them. And as you go through car by car, you realize that you are not one of the refugees. You are not the dregs. You are the one eating sushi. I don't know how much the film wanted to implicate its audience in the social stratification narrative, but I thought that was really interesting, because these people are the refugees, and the audience, the people watching the film, are the captors, essentially. Mm. So I thought that was a really interesting thing to do, and something that you don't often see in a Hollywood blockbuster. Most of the time, Hollywood blockbusters are pure escapism. That's their function. But this movie doesn't let you off the hook that easily. Mm. So I don't know. If nothing else, there's something to be said for that, I think. Yeah. But Gabe, not so much.
I just think that so much of it was so poorly executed that I didn't. I guess I was taken out of it. They seemed to have the one thing they seemed to be stuck on, I felt, or the only thing that they were making clear, is that rich people are bad and poor people are good. Mm-hmm. But then they kind of stabbed themselves in the back by making the poor people horrible as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't think that was the message, that the rich people are bad and poor people are good. I felt like the rich people in the film, aside from the guards, they were sort of ignorant to what was going on in that last car. They were perhaps willfully ignorant, but it didn't seem like there was a lot of interaction between the cars. They aren't allowed to communicate with each other.
That's true. And it was interesting how that was one thing that I thought was really cool, when they get past the classroom, and then the egg distributor comes.
Yeah.
It was so cool how they had been coming up the whole time, and it was always from their perspective coming forward, and then suddenly they realize that there are guys behind them now, and then we jumped and we were coming from the bad guys' perspective, and they were coming forward and coming forward. That was really neat. How that
there's
switched.
A it's kind of there's like I kept thinking during the film as I was watching it, because we're progressing through this train, but there's some logistical questions that I have.
That's
in mind.
True. Yes. Like, why did
I thought that was
days?
Flawless.
I mean, you have to really like suspend a lot of disbelief to that. Okay, all of humanity is living on this train, and they've got facilities to sustain life. And I mean, I kept thinking, okay, if they were technologically advanced enough on this train to like be able to sustain life independent of anything else, and this is a in the future from us, yet they seem to have no idea up front that an insurrection is happening. When they walk into the next train, people are like, oh, what are you doing? Like, there's no like security cameras so that they can keep track of them up front of what's happening. It seemed like, oh, it was a surprise that there's people now making their way through the thing, and they've killed a bunch of our guards.
And who is that guy, the one dude that would kind of hang back, and then he would come running through with his shirt off and grab them? Like, yeah, why wasn't that guy at the front of the battle, like from the beginning? Like, oh, and we have this one guy, but he's not going to come out until...
Got the element of surprise.
Right, until 74% of us are dead. Uh-huh. Then he'll come out.
Right. But I did think it was interesting that Chris Evans makes a natural protagonist, because the audience is going to assume that he's a good guy. He's Captain America. And it turns out that what Gabe was saying about him eating babies makes him a natural person to take over the running of the train. So in a twist.
Yeah, that's true. It makes him, you can actually, I think the function of that does make it so you can believe that he would take over.
Right.
You know, in that big Scooby-Doo scene at the end where Edward Harris is like, you know, telling us the whole
right,
story.
Right.
You know,
yeah. The extended sequence with Ed Harris, I felt sort of, like there's this very, I thought it was interesting throughout the film, there are these very distinct changes of pace. Like they really do take time, as you were saying, sit down. We're gonna talk for a second. Give us a minute.
Yeah, got to give time for the ravers to amass themselves
and just
the final
sort
attack.
Of come down from their high, and just sort of collect themselves, right. Put on their hats and their masks.
But there is something. There's obviously some. They have to spout some philosophy because this film does have higher aims, and there is probably a more seamless way to incorporate that.
Well, that's the thing that I wouldn't say there is a more seamless way. There is. You know, a far better way. You know, the whole, you know, storytelling axiom, like, show me, don't tell me, you know, and it's just when the characters have to stand there, it brings to mind bad high school theater. You know?
Tell me if you think this, you buy this. I think if that Wilfred character had been played by someone else, like someone way cooler, it may have worked better. And if
oh,
it had been
really?
Cut, I
wow.
think.
Wow,
Because I do think Ed Harris is a very good actor, and he has been good in the past. But I wasn't sure that he was cast correctly.
You think like Ian McKellen or something?
Yeah, maybe a little Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart. What if Patrick Stewart had been there?
I don't know. I thought that he was pretty good.
I don't know if I had specifically complaints about it being Ed Harris. I just think it was poorly written and conceived.
Fair enough. Yeah.
To have that. For me, it's just like I say, it felt like the end of a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the mechanics of this movie do not make sense,
no.
as Tad said. But I do think it's an ambitious political allegory. And I think that's an interesting thing to do in a major action movie, in a genre film. This movie is addressing a lot of issues that are brought up constantly in the news and all, you know, in editorials and all that stuff. So, but I thought it was sort of an interesting take because it does seem to be looking at it from a more global perspective, this trouble with income inequality, economic inequality. In our popular culture, we think of the 99% versus the 1%. But this movie is suggesting that even within the entire world, even the 99% of Americans are still in that top and towards the front of that train. So I thought that was an interesting way to approach it. And given that there were some monetary restrictions, I mean, it's like a $40 million budget, which seems like a lot of money, but for a film of this scale, that's actually not that much, believe it or not.
And with that many actors, recognizable actors.
Right,
you know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think given that, I think the film was very visually striking. Yes, there were, the effects probably are not of Hollywood Michael Bay caliber, but I thought much of the film was much more interesting to look at than Transformers, personally. Especially that scene where they come with the fire. That was cool.
That was cool. I mean, I kind of, less so towards the end, but towards the beginning, I kept thinking of Brazil, Terry Gilliam's Brazil, you know, as this sort of, just in the look and the tone of this futuristic dystopian kind of idea. Like, I just kept thinking, I haven't seen that film in a long time, but that's the one that I was reminded of most as I was watching the first half of it.
Yeah. Anyway, any final thoughts on the film? Gabe, one more rant?
No, I'm
said
done.
Your piece.
I've said my piece. And I just, you know, look forward to the sequel with, you know, with, and what is that polar bear gonna do?
I know.
The madcap hijinks of a small African-American boy.
I want to see the human polar bear hybrid. That'll be great.
I mean, my final analysis would be, if you have high expectations, let me put it the other way. If I have low expectations, it will exceed them.
Yeah.
It was better than I expected.
Yeah. Do you think that's what happened? Why does it have a 90-something percent on Rotten Tomatoes?
I mean, maybe there's just the flashy element of it that people like the you know, the cool fight scenes and stuff. And that's what I enjoyed that paired with the sort of oddball off the wall scenes in the sushi scene, the classroom scene, that stuff. And then it falls apart at the end for me, like it does for Gabe. Mm-hmm. So it's like I really enjoyed it, but it's not a great film, but I had a good time watching it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I guess I sort of agree with you, Tad. I think it's a fun movie to watch, though very violent. I will say that I appreciate that this movie had higher ambitions than just to entertain, mm-hmm. and that was made very clear. And I like how it played with our expectations. And I felt like it had a very distinctive point of view. But I do agree that third act was kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, check it out and let us know what you think. We've come to our last stop. But before we get off this train, we're all going to take a couple of minutes for our final notes of positivity. Gabe, what's one piece of culture or art or media that you'd like to revel in for a minute?
It is Google Hangout.
Okay.
my brothers and I like to collaborate on projects, and one's in Texas, one's in Ventura, one's in Chatsworth. And so, you know, we can put together projects on, you know, like rough cuts on YouTube, and then do a Google Hangout, and we can all watch it and collaborate on it, talk about it, share things, and it's pretty cool.
All right. A little shout out to our benevolent overlords, Google.
I haven't used that yet. Now you make me want to give it a shot. Man.
Yeah, it's cool.
All right, Tad, how about you?
Well, I will just talk real quick about my favorite movie of the year so far, which has gotten super mixed reviews, understandably, but it was not a big hit necessarily, but I fell in love with it. It was Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer's recent Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. Unlike any other sci-fi film I've seen in recent memory, it's lots of overtones of Kubrick and Antonioni, some of my favorite filmmakers, but just very mysterious. And I saw it twice in the theater, and I'm still trying to figure it out, which I love a movie that 2 months after I first saw it, I'm still at least a couple times a week going, man, Under the Skin. I still haven't figured it all out, but there's this feeling, this essence, something to it that there's a mystery that I'm just like enthralled by. I can't explain it, but I love it, and I hope a lot of people see it.
Yeah, cool. I've heard actually a lot of people feel that way. It's getting a lot of notices still to this day. People are still talking about it, mm-hmm. so that's a good one. So I'm going to cheat on mine a little bit, because I know last time I did this, I said I was not going to talk about a television show. But alas, I just can't help myself. And I'm also going to cheat. I'm going to cheat
Is it going to be another Star Trek?
It may or may not be Star Trek related. But I've decided that this topic that I'm going to spout off about in a second is too important and too excellent to just be condensed into a couple of final notes of positivity. So I've decided I'm going to do a whole show on this, but it's the show Orange is the New Black. There is a Star Trek connection. I have mentioned Kate Mulgrew was one of my final notes of positivity in the past, and she is featured on this show, and she is the best character in a cast full of and a just great ensemble. But so next week, the next podcast will be a spoiler special or just an Orange is the New Black special. But until then, I'll just leave you with this. This show is getting pretty much across, like, rave reviews across the board. It's nominated for several Emmys, I think 12 Emmys. But a lot of people don't like the theme song. And I'm just going to go ahead and put it out there. I think the theme song is great. Okay, so take comfort, Regina Spektor. It's Regina Spektor, You've Got Time. I think it suits the show perfectly. There, I said it. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. If you'd like to weigh in on any of the topics we discussed on today's show, feel free to leave us a comment on our show page, FlixWise.com. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/FlixWise. You can follow us on Twitter at FlixWise. But most importantly, Please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Make sure to tell Apple how great we are. And as I mentioned, our next show will be an Orange is the New Black special. But the following week, we'll be back on Sight and Sound duty with the 17th greatest movie of all time. In this case, we actually have our first tie. It's between Ingmar Bergman's Persona and Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. But we're going to do Bergman first. So make sure to tune in for that. In the meantime, Tad, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, we'll have you. You're tapped. You're in.
Oh, awesome. Can't wait till the next one.
Exactly. Gabe, so good to see your shining face back on the show.
Thank you. Yeah. I have some cream for that shine.
Listeners can't tell, but Gabe's face is very shiny. Yeah, until we meet again, keep an eye out for the polar bears.